I'm Elizabeth Hodson. Welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. On today's programme, I'll be looking at how stories are used to sell us things. We'll hear true tales of risking life and limb for a cup of coffee.
A lot of the agriculture zones in Colombia are red zones. For you to get the best coffees, you actually have to go in there. It's just the way it is. Is it worth it? 100%.
And I visit a company which elevates the backstory to an art form.
A great backstory should ideally be able to be made into a feature film. We look at a backstory and say, could we make an entertaining, compelling hour and a half out of this?
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC. You'd be forgiven for thinking that the cult of the backstory started with Simon Cowell, the media mogul who made cold, hard cash through our supposed need for an emotional connection. On one of his most famous shows, The X Factor, you could have a great song and a wonderful voice, but without a tale to tell, worthy of a Shakespearean tragedy, you might as well go home now. Because the backstory is key. And this trend for storytelling is increasingly important in the global marketplace. In a retail environment where chains are king and you can get a Big Mac and fries anywhere from Seoul to Santiago, authenticity, or rather the appearance of authenticity, is everything. Tesco, a huge supermarket chain, is currently running a campaign featuring food love stories, which uses heartwarming personal tales to sell everyday cooking ingredients. And Cadbury, part of food manufacturing conglomerate Mondelez International, uses its website to lovingly set out its illustrious history, going back to 1824, when John Cadbury personally made drinking chocolate with a pestle and mortar. In a world where you can get what you want, when you want it, realness is priceless.
What people want now is a backstory that's got virtue, artisanness, and ideally purity, organicness. Good people making good things in a virtuous way.
That's Peter York, a marketing expert who I met up with in Shoreditch in East London. Once a run-down, scruffy wasteland with a reputation for dodgy pubs and petty crime, in the last decade or so, Shoreditch has risen from the ashes of neglect and dereliction to become a haven for trendy under-35s. In London's cradle of cool, you'll find artisan chocolate makers charging $20 for a modest bar of apparently handcrafted confectionery, and the streets are lined with exclusive coffee emporia, bursting with heady aromas and sky-high prices.
People want something that's defining and that has meaning. They also want things that are little treats.
Now, of course, one of the major beneficiaries of the drive for authenticity and backstory is the coffee industry. And just across the street, there's a very well-known, it's a small chain called All Press. It's pretty cold. Let's nip in for one.
Basically, a backstory is the building blocks of a brand. You can charge more for it and you will make a higher profit on it. It's a form of modern-day magic, and it's a sort of substitute religion.
Authenticity is especially important for one group of consumers, millennials. That's people born between 1980 and 2000. It's an age group which values experiences over mere consumerism. Alex Castellano, former head of design at file transfer service Dropbox, said that millennials are a generation that want to co-create the product with you. Companies that understand this will have an edge. Management consultants Accenture estimate that by 2020, millennials' spending in the United States will grow to $1.4 trillion annually and represent 30% of total retail sales. So it's certainly a market worth chasing. Something that Shoreditch is adept at doing, right down to the street art.
Having graffiti around is like making the Stations of the Cross. It's paying your due. clues to the fact that this area has got a bit of a background. If there isn't any graffiti on your wall, you can telephone for emergency graffiteers.
The idea of authenticity is also deeply ingrained in the food industry. From fruit smoothies to whole chickens, the packaging falls over itself to tell us where it's from or who grew it and why we should care. Food, in short, is where storytelling comes into its own. I travelled into the bowels of the British Library to find out more.
My name is Polly Russell and I work as a curator at the British Library. For a long time, I've been very interested in ideas about food and narrative and identity. So food and stories is what I'm interested in.
What is the link between food, the story, and the notion that food has to have a story?
It would be really hard to disassociate the idea of food and stories because food is so central to who we are as social beings. It's so bound up with how we are placed in time, how we are placed geographically, you know, who we are, how we feel. And so stories, as in what we understand about food, where it's come from, are integral to our experience of food and eating. They sort of mediate the food you're eating. They tell you whether it's going to be safe to eat. And that safe literally has this thing come from a safe source. Can I put it in my mouth and swallow it? But also kind of metaphorically, you know, do I understand where it's come from? Is it risky? Am I prepared to take that risk? And when you have a story associated with food, it mediates some of that anxiety. When you see the rise of industrialized branded foods, you know, branded industrialized food is not closely connected to the consumer in terms of production. There's a distance between what you eat and where it's been produced. And the stories of branding of food help to mediate that distance. They tell you that the food that has been produced in this massive factory 100,000 miles away are knowable, safe, familiar. And that's very important. Stories are very powerful when it comes to making us understand and like particular foods and food traditions.
The idea of using food to communicate what's important to us, our thoughts, feelings, motivations and desires, is the very essence of a rather exclusive restaurant. Michelin-starred chef Tom Sellers opened his restaurant Story in 2013. A surprisingly small metal and wooden structure, it clings to the edge of the kerb in the fashionable London Bridge enclave of East London. Since opening, it's attracted a cult following of foodies, desperate to dive into the tales of the unexpected that permeate the menu. Keen to get on with the day's work, Tom sat down with me one morning before service to explain his novel approach to fine dining.
I came up with the idea for the restaurant probably 10, 11 years ago. I was cooking at Per Se at the time, which is a restaurant in America owned by Thomas Keller,
where the set menu costs a modest $325.
I had this kind of brainchild idea about having a narrative that runs alongside food. I think anyone that can connect to a story instantly feels more engaged with what they're doing. The stories come from all different kinds of influences. You know, some may be a childhood story or something that's influenced my life personally. It may be about a supplier, a farmer, a grower, and the story that we have with them and the connection we have with them. But I think ultimately all stories lead back to why we created the food that we created.
In front of us is one of your most well-known dishes. It doesn't actually look like food at all. You've got a candle holder with a candle in it. There's no suggestion whatsoever that this is edible. So what is it?
It's essentially a candle made from beef dripping. We take the beef fat and we slightly salt it and cure it. We whip it and then we shape it into candles. And then we light it at the table like you'd light a normal candle and it melts. And then you dip your bread inside what would be seen to be the wax, but obviously it's beef fat. And the story behind that was my father used to eat beef dripping every Sunday. I was inspired by going back in time, and I think if you look back, you know, a tallow candle was a candle that was made of beef fat originally, never meant to be consumed, but was always meant to have a function of light and heat.
The menu itself is in the shape of a book. There's a foreword, it's snacks, and then we have childhood bread and dripping, onion and lovage, chapter 2, razor clam, king crab, scallop. It looks like a collection of ingredients. You wouldn't know exactly what you're eating. Is the mystery a part of the experience as well?
until the food comes to the table, you don't know in what guise or form it's going to come to you. Yeah, that all adds to the experience. With there being less description on the menu, it means that the chefs or the waiters need to engage more with the customer too, right, to explain it and tell the story of the dish.
And luxury brands have a lot to gain from a good backstory.
This is a relatively new cohort of brands, these artisan, handmade by hipsters sort of brands. We don't know whether they'll last the course. What we do know about is a different kind of brand magic, which is luxury brands and designer brands. And if you have a successful luxury or designer brand, meaning people respect it and are prepared to pay a premium with anything that bears its name, then you have a license to print money.
That's two flat whites.
I've come to the London Coffee Festival, and being the hipster event that it is, it's being held here in Shoreditch. You'll find coffees from countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, places that only a few years ago were no-go areas. And the very fact that something is hard to get can add to its exclusivity. There's that frisson of excitement in knowing that the caffeinated brown liquid in your cup comes from a war zone. And sourcing coffee from war zones is something that Steve Sutton specialises in. From his shop in New York's trendy Williamsburg, he sells cups of Joe from some of the most dangerous areas in South America.
I'm from Colombia. I left Colombia when I was young and I came to the States. Fast forward to 2014, we decided to open our roastery. And inside that roastery, we decided that we're going to put a coffee shop. We want to treat this as the most amazing gastronomical item out there. The beans that I'm roasting is actually fresh. And this type of coffee, very, very few people have the opportunity to actually taste.
When I was reading your website, you mention Colombia's red zones, areas with significant guerrilla activity. This sounds like a pretty hazardous place to go for your coffee. Why do you take the risk, and is it worth it?
Colombia, unfortunately, has a lot of red zones. We are a country that until very recently has been in a conflict. And a lot of the agriculture zones in Colombia are red zones, and you just really have to be able to maneuver through them to not get into trouble. But for you to get the best coffees out there, you actually have to go in there. Is it worth it? 100%.
Do you think this kind of sourcing adds an element of excitement to people's perception of your brand? When they come in for a cup of coffee, they know that you've tried really hard to get this into the shop.
Yeah, I mean, people appreciate the authenticity and definitely they appreciate the flavor that it all translates to.
Steve knows that when he sells a cup of coffee, he's selling a story of danger and jeopardy. But not every product has such a pedigree. So what do you do if you want that golden halo of authenticity but don't have a tale of drama and intrigue to back it up?
If you don't, on the face of it, have a backstory, you can get a designer. There are lots and lots of graphic designers practicing right round here. And you can get one of those designers to invent you an implicit backstory, which comes in terms of the way the product is packaged, in the way that it's presented, in the way that it's advertised and put across.
As a gin fan, I'd love to launch my own brand, but I don't want an implicit backstory. I want to go one better and get a real one. I've got no idea where to start, so I'm going to see a man who does. He's Simon Manchip, founder of Someone, a brand and design agency, right here in Shoreditch. What makes a great backstory?
I think a great backstory should ideally be able to be made into a feature film. We look at a backstory and say, could we make an entertaining, compelling, and internationally recognised hour and a half out of this? If you look at a lot of the great brands, they could easily be made into that.
I'm not in line for an inheritance, but if I was, I would be very tempted to set up my own gin brand. So imagine I've inherited $5 million, but this gin will be a new product. I don't have a backstory. How do I create a backstory? How do I make this an authentic product that people will want to pay $40 or $50 for?
You will have an authentic story. There is always a story. There's always authenticity. What we would probably do is sit down with you and just try and find out where you had this idea, or where you were, or who you were with, or what you were wearing. For example, the fact that you're wearing a blue jumper right now, we could base the whole brand on the blue jumper that you're wearing and call it Blue Jumper Gin. It doesn't mean that you have to have some deep story that goes back hundreds of years to your ancestors or indeed to your location. It can be much more to do with the fact that actually you've just got a great idea on the spur of the moment, and that could actually be the spirit of the brand literally as you go through it.
Could you show me how you would build my brand?
Maybe the botanicals that we're using that add those amazing flavours, the junipers, etc., come from a particular part of the world. You've got a friend in Croydon that grows them, you know, or something like that. You could have a berry wearing a jumper, for example, something like that. So it's charming. If you can find a charmless sector and introduce charmlet, you're very likely to win and have an advantage.
Great. So on the label, we're going to have a juniper berry in a jumper.
Yeah, we are. Believe it or not, we are. Let's embrace weird. Weird often works in these instances.
How do you think my gin will do? Do you think it'll be a bestseller?
So, I mean, overnight success is a very rare thing, and I'm afraid we will have to work at this. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that branding is never finished. It's a constant iterative process. So the first launch of this gin will probably be received well by some parties and poorly by others, and we will learn and create you another version.
We could actually have Blue Jumper Gin, the feature film.
Absolutely, where we could do the story based on that moment where you had that idea, you were wearing that blue jumper very fetchingly, then the rest became history.
And I will retire with millions and millions of dollars in the bank and an internationally recognised gin brand that will still be completely authentic and true to its roots.
We would hope so, yes.
It seems a good backstory is an integral part of the strategy for many brands, however creatively that story came about.